Arthur Kemp, I'm delighted and honored to have you here. So thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure, Lana. I think you and Red Ice do a great job, and I'm very honored to be on your show.
Well, it's refreshing to speak with you because I've actually tried doing a couple white archaeology shows with some racialists, but it never turns out good. And unfortunately, it can come across a little wacky sometimes. I'm sure you've come across that too.
Unfortunately, I've had more than my fair share of dealing with wacky people, so I know exactly what you're talking about. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. I think what happens a lot of the time is that people tend to overplay what the reality is, and sometimes if they're not happy with the reality, they add to it. And I think that's quite common amongst not only people in this so-called white nationalist movement, but probably everywhere.
Yep. Well, when I mentioned to our listeners that you were coming on, a lot of people responded and saying how March of the Titans was a major eye-opener for them. And for me, you know, I just love Eurocentric history and archaeology. March of the Titans, it's a masterful body of work. And so I wanted to read a quote to kind of summarize it. "Most importantly, revealed in this work is the one true cause of the rise and fall of the world's greatest empires, that all civilizations rise and fall according to their racial homogeneity and nothing else. A nation can survive wars, defeats, catastrophes, but not racial dissolution, aka diversity," right? So Rome didn't collapse from debauchery and decadence. So where do you like to begin when approaching this subject with newcomers?
Well, the very first way to understand it is to take a step back away from any idea of denigrating other people. That's probably a very important basis to start with. It's one of the biggest problems in this so-called movement is that it seems to be based more on putting other people down. You don't have to put anyone else down. All you have to do is stand back and look at it from a purely objective point of view. What causes culture? What causes civilization? And how do these things change? Now, my basis, whenever anyone asks me, "Oh, can you explain what you mean?" I always say, look, it's very simple. Each culture, each civilization is a product of a certain people. So, for example, the Chinese people created a Chinese civilization, the Japanese people created a Japanese civilization, the Australian Aborigines created Australian Aborigines civilization, and the Europeans created European civilization. Now, you don't have to be subjective about any of them. Of course, we all like to think that our own version is better, but that's a subjective opinion. We can be objective about it. We can say, yes, look, Europeans created European civilization, so on and so forth. Now, and generally everyone will say, yes, well, that's obvious. Obviously, Europeans created European civilization. Obviously, Chinese people created Chinese civilization, so on and so forth. Once you've got them to agree with that very basic and very simple fact, then all you do, you say to them, well, what happens if all the Chinese people had to vanish tomorrow? What would happen to Chinese civilization? Oh, well, probably it would disappear. Yes, obviously. If the Japanese people disappear tomorrow, would anything remain of Japanese civilization? No. If the Australian Aborigine people disappear tomorrow, would anything remain of their culture and their civilization? No. So therefore, obviously, if the European people disappear, nothing will remain of their culture or their civilization. Yes. And everyone will say, well, yes, that's pretty obvious. I said, well, there you go. That is the cause of the explanation of the rise and fall of all civilizations. If the people who created a civilization disappear for any reason, whether it be replacement through mass immigration, whether it be through extermination in warfare or death by disease or whatever, if a founding population disappears, that founding population's culture and civilization will disappear with it. And once you've got that particular, and that's a very basic, it's not a radical position, and there's almost no one I've ever met anywhere in the world that's been able to disagree with that. Once you've got them to understand that basic principle, then all you have to do is show that every great civilization in history, no matter what its race, no matter what its origin, that every great civilization has vanished once the people who created it vanish. And if you can get people to understand that very, very simple, very basic principle, then history stops becoming a jumble of meaningless dates and events, and you can see a very clear flow in it.
Yeah, and you've done a beautiful job outlining a lot of these civilizations. Egypt's a classic one that people like to point to. And then you also mentioned like the Great Depression or Germany after World War II, how all these countries have been able to pull themselves up after these events because racially it was still homogenous, right?
That's exactly the point. Germany is actually a good case in point, what you're talking about, because a lot of people say, oh, the Roman Empire collapsed because the barbarians sacked Rome in 453, and that was the end of Rome. In actual fact, the Celts sacked Rome in 212 BC, but Rome came back. Rome eventually conquered the Celts after the Celts sacked Rome. So you're absolutely right. People who believe, for example, that a military defeat would be the cause of a collapse of an empire, you're right. You know, 80% of Germany was flattened to the ground in 1945, and by 1955, 1960, it was once again the strongest nation in Western Europe. If debauchery, if moral degeneracy would be the reason for the collapse of a civilization, then I can assure you Britain should have collapsed in the 1600s. You look at the debauched histories of the royal families of Britain, and I'm not picking on Britain in particular, but it is a good example. If you look at the murders of each other and brothers killing each other and all sorts of horrible things, moral debauchery should have finished off Britain many, many, many centuries ago. And of course, that didn't happen, precisely because, as you said there, that if as long as a founding population remains in place, as long as it remains the majority of population, and as long as it remains homogenous, that society will continue to be in existence.
Well, I know this is nearly impossible to answer, but according to history, from what you've seen, what or who in these societies begins pushing towards diversity, if you will?
Yeah, now that's the great question. I know a lot of people say, oh, it's the Jews, or oh, it's this, or oh, it's Christianity, or oh, it's this religion, or that religion, or this belief system. I'm sorry to say, but in almost every case that I can think of, it's simple ignorance of the long-term racial consequences of using foreign labor.
Mm-hmm.
And the example that I always use is, for example, if someone had to invent a time machine, which would be great, but if someone had to invent a time machine and I could go back to pre-Civil War Atlanta in Georgia and fly out there and pick up one of those big cotton plantation owners who's got his 500 Negro slaves slaving away in the field, picking his cotton, making him and his family a very rich man, put him in a time machine and take him to Atlanta, Georgia in 2016 and drop him off in the middle of Atlanta and say, look here, the direct consequence of you and the small number of plantation owners who use black labor is that your great-grandchildren cannot walk the streets of Atlanta, Georgia, cannot walk the streets of your state's capital anymore because the place is now taken over by blacks. And it's now unsafe for white people to walk in the street. I'm quite sure that that plantation owner never dreamed, never wanted in his wildest imagining, never wanted that for his great-grandchildren. But he didn't understand the long-term consequences of using foreign labor. And I think this played out in Egypt, this played out in Sumeria, this played out in every great civilization that has fallen, or in South Africa, or in Rhodesia. I don't think they understood the consequences of using it. So it's easy to blame others, and certainly others do have a role to play. I'm not denying that, but I'm afraid the truth which hurts is that it's quite often white people themselves who don't have an understanding of the global geopolitical racial consequences of their actions.
Now, one thing, you know, English always get blamed for is colonialism. And I always say English colonialism cannot at all be compared to the mass invasion of today. But what are your thoughts on English colonialism? Was it wrong?
Yes, I'm a firm anti-colonialist. There are two ways to approach colonialism. Colonialism that's done on a Ragnar Redbeard might is right principle is a immutable law of nature. Almost every colonization process has been probably undertaken on that basis. Just to divert for one second, you do know, of course, that the first colonizers of anywhere were in fact non-Europeans colonizing Europe.
Yes.
It's a factual inaccuracy to say that Europeans started the colonization process. In actual fact, the first great colonizing invasions were of non-Europeans into Europe. So if anyone should be screaming for reparations, it should be the Europeans. Now, leaving that aside, if you look at the English colonization process, when, for example, if you're going to colonize a place properly, and I'm now divorcing it from any moral issues, because I believe there is a moral issue at play here, but if you're going to divorce it from a moral issue, the way you colonize a place is you move in and you push out, you eradicate the native inhabitants, and you occupy the territory and you take it over. Okay? A good example of English colonialism that was done this way would have been Australia. Okay, or the United States of America. They simply pushed the native, I don't want to call them the Native Americans because they weren't even native. I want to call them the American Indians. They simply pushed them out through mass immigration, and they simply took their lands and they colonized them. They fought them, defeated the Indians, and that was it. That's how America was colonized. That's how Australia was colonized. Now, in those days, morally, no one thought anything of it because that's how all of history had run. I think that we nowadays have reached the stage where all of society has advanced and we can take moral judgments on things. Say, for example, and here's the great case, the Jews all move into Palestine, beat up the Palestinians, kick the Palestinians out, torture them, oppress them. I think we have a right to say, listen here, the time has moved on. This is no longer 1700 or 1800 where people could get away with such immoral or morally questionable things as colonizing and beating up a native population. And therefore, Israel should be criticized for colonizing Palestine at the expense of the Palestinians. Because that's essentially what they've done. They've adopted the Ragnar Redbeard approach of driving the Palestinians out. Now, that might have been acceptable in 1800 or 1700 as the English did in America or Australia. But it's no longer acceptable in this day and age. Going back to, if you look at English colonization, for example, in where I was born, Rhodesia, what was then southern Rhodesia when I was born there, you look at English colonization there, that wasn't done on a might is right principle. That was done on a white supremacist principle, where a small number of whites moved in and established a government to rule over the many, many, many more millions, in fact, of blacks. Now, a white supremacist government, apart from its moral questionability, is also doomed to failure because it ignores the demographic principle which governs all society. Those who make up the majority of people in a society determine the nature and direction of that society. And that's why white supremacism never works, and it's actually a recipe for failure. Apartheid in South Africa was another system like that, designed on minority rule over a majority population, guaranteed to fail over the long term, no matter what the short-term policy applications were. So yes, we can now, from the advantage of many centuries later, say, well, it wasn't really fair of the English to colonize North America or the Germans or the French or whoever all took part in it, because they all took part in it. But I think we can now look back and say, look, it was done. We can draw a line underneath it. And we can say we now deal with the reality of the situation as we have it now. And if we adopt the principle that it was wrong for the English to colonize any part of the world, or it was wrong for the Europeans to colonize any part of the world, therefore it is also wrong for the third world to colonize any part of the world as well. So, if it was wrong for the English to colonize America, but that's now done, then it is also wrong for the Mexicans to colonize America in this day and age as well. Or it is wrong for Africa to colonize Europe in this day and age just because Europeans colonized Africa in the 1600s or 1700s.
Now, would you say there's a difference, though, between colonialism and exploration? Because, you know, white people, we explored, you know, we cataloged plants and animals, we learned so much, right?
Huge difference between exploration and colonization. Absolutely massive. You're right. Absolutely right. I think that exploring the world was something that Europeans had to do. It's no coincidence that Europeans explored the world and no one else did. I think that's an inherent racial difference which is still valid to this very day. And certainly, but I think, look, as I said to you, I'm not going to condemn people for what they did in 1700 or 1600. Yeah. That was the norm at the time. It's like condemning people for not allowing women to have the vote. You know, most people, I know there's some people in the alt-right who don't think so, but most people today would not suggest that women shouldn't have the vote. But, you know, 100 years ago, it was a accepted principle that women didn't have the vote. Now, one can sit nowadays and moralize on that, or you can say, well, that was the norm at the time. I'm not going to condemn anybody for holding the views which were dominant at that time, but these are the values which we have today. And you're right. I think colonization is a morally you can judge colonization only in the morals of the time. You can't judge it by today's morals and standards.
Yeah, I suppose the better thing to do would have been to explore and perhaps help or interact with people who wanted helping or wanted to trade information and learn skills from each other, but then leave afterwards and not settle there for good, because there's a difference between having an exchange and permanently living there, which creates problems, right?
Correct. And I think the immigration crisis that faces the First World today is the direct product of colonization. Let me explain it to you this way, and I can explain it to you because of my own personal experiences in Rhodesia and South Africa. Before the arrival of the white colonists, the average black reproduction rate, the average black woman would have had maybe from the time of puberty to the time of whenever they would die, and they died in the early age of in their 40s or something like that. But from puberty to the time of the cessation of their reproductive life cycle, put it that way, they would have maybe 20 pregnancies. But before the advent of white colonization, of those 20 pregnancies, probably 17 or 18 would die either in pregnancy or would be stillborn or would starve to death or whatever the case was. So their population numbers were always in proportion to the land's ability to support their subsistence existence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so along comes Whitey, along comes the white colonist, sometimes with a gun in one hand and a Bible in the other, or sometimes just holding a Bible, or sometimes just holding a gun. But whatever it is, he comes along and he sets up a society and he says, wow, look at this infant mortality rate. It's terrible. How can you have an infant mortality rate of 95%? We've got to fix this. It's our Christian duty. It's our moral duty. It's our whatever duty to do this. And so what they do is they bring in hospitals, they bring in schools, they bring in medicine, they bring in education. Now, the black woman is no longer having a 95% infant mortality rate. Now she has a 10 or 15% infant mortality rate. So what happens to the black population? It skyrockets.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in South Africa. There's a good test. If you look up, and you can see it, find it online nowadays. You can find the 1913 Encyclopedia Britannica, the famous 11th edition. It's the grandest Encyclopedia Britannica of all time. And you look up there, they have a section there on the Transvaal, which was the Boer Republic of the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek that was taken over, occupied, militarily occupied by the British during the Second Anglo-Boer War. And the British conducted the first census in the Transvaal, in the ZAR. And they found the census figures, and I'm speaking under correction, but I'm pretty sure the figures are close to this, that there were just under 300,000 Europeans in the Transvaal,
mm-hmm.
and about 690,000 Africans in the Transvaal in 1907. And if you look at the disproportionate population growth between 1907 and, say, 1990, which is not long, it's 80-something odd years. If you look at the disproportionate growth, you will find that by 1990, there were, I think, 1.2 million Europeans, and I think in the region of 12 to 14 million Africans. Now, the population growth is exclusively due to the introduction of white medicine, white education, giving them jobs and giving them employment. In other words, artificially boosting their population. Now, this has happened all over Africa, and it's still going on. All this Doctors Without Borders and Live Aid and, you know, Help the Starving Ethiopians. What happens? Whites go over there, interfere with the natural nature's ordering of the population, and all of a sudden you've got these huge extra populations who are incapable of feeding themselves, incapable of organizing any agriculture, incapable of basically of doing anything except breeding more. And whoops, now where they're all gonna, now they're pouring into Europe. And the same thing's happening in South and Latin America as well. And that's why you've got the problem in the US. Well, where all this population, well, from Central and South America, where's it all coming from? It's simply they've been bred up by white colonialism.
That's right. We're always trying to create order everywhere. And I've heard, too, apartheid, one of the things is they were trying to create peace among the tribes, right? Because all the tribes were also killing each other. But that's one way that the population was also staying low, right?
I don't think intertribal warfare killed so many as did disease and starvation. People who aren't familiar with Africa, let me rephrase that. Europeans who aren't liberals, who aren't familiar with Africa, don't understand exactly how backward Africa was. Another one of my favorite stories, just to illustrate this point, is when you read the diaries of Dr. Kenneth Livingstone, the great explorer Livingstone, you know, the guy, Stanley, Dr. Livingstone, yes. I presume, mm-hmm. you know that story. If you read his diaries, he describes going into an African village in 1871. So that's not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. And he describes he's got a donkey and a cart. He couldn't use a horse because the horses all died from African horse sickness. We had a donkey, which was somehow resistant to a mule, to African horse sickness. Anyway, and he describes in this diary so nicely how he's riding up into this village of about 4,000 souls, and all the Africans come out, and they're all stark naked because they haven't got clothes, and they're all standing on the side of this path, this rudimentary path that he's coming trotting up in his cart and his donkey, and you see all their heads are going round and round and round like they're watching some type of big Ferris wheel. And he can't work it out. Why their heads will be? He thinks maybe it's some type of tribal greeting. And then he realizes they're looking at the wheels on his cart. They've never seen the wheel before.
Yeah, I know.
So you're dealing with the people who 100 years ago didn't have the wheel.
Yeah.
So there's no ways they're going to be resistant to any type of bacteria or going to have any type of medicine or anything like that at all. So, yeah, tribal warfare played its role, but tribal warfare it was a summer activity. It wasn't a winter activity. They didn't fight each other during the winter. And let's be honest, Europeans have a good long history of tribal warfare as well.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We do better than anyone else, I think. I've actually been through Africa, and I've been to parts of Africa out in the bush where I was the first white person a lot of these mm-hmm. kids saw. I actually have photos of that. So, yeah, I've seen firsthand how some of them live, and they still have their witch doctors and all kinds of fun stuff.
Oh, no, they're witch doctors in Birmingham and in England nowadays. You can look them up in the local newspaper, Dr. Ujubi to cure impotence, financial trouble, and anything else. No, I'm not joking. That third world moves with them.
Now, what about the out of Africa theory? Obviously, I know you're not a believer of it. I don't either. But, you know, if we come from Africa, then what's the problem? Why can't we be there, right?
Well, that is true. First of all, there are a number of problems with the out of Africa theory in my point of view. And I remember having this great discussion with Dr. Philip Rushton once. Sadly, he's passed away, but he was a great believer in the out of Africa theory. But the discussion that I had with him on this basis was, well, number one, the time periods that we're talking about, the continents weren't even formed properly, so you can't even say out of Africa, really, if one is going to believe the continental shifts and the drifts and that type of thing. Secondly, the out of Africa theory relies on genetic mutation over a period of between 120 and 150,000 years. That's the most common time period which they say that the Great Migration out of Central Africa came then and branched off into Asia, and then one lot went into Europe, and then they mutated out according to their environments. You know the theory. Now, as I said to Dr. Rushton at the time, Professor Rushton at the time, is that if this is true, this would imply that people are walking, right? Because they haven't got cars, they haven't got wagons, they haven't got anything. They're walking. They're walking a hell of a long way to get to Europe and to get to Asia. That normal migration periods would take, you know, hundreds of years to cross even a small part of Africa. Never mind those huge distances. So we're actually probably looking at a genetic mutation period of maybe half that time, maybe 50,000 years, maybe 60,000 years. So what you're trying to tell me is that the out of Africa theory means that some form of Homo habilis, some form of semi-ape thing, sort of jumped out of the trees, ran across the plains of Africa, ran into Asia, ran into over the Alps into Europe, and within 50,000 years evolved into Nordics, evolved into Mongoloid racial types, evolved into the various specific racial types that we have today. And I just can't see it. Yeah. I just cannot see it. And for me, the killer argument against that theory is, of course, the existence of racial differences, because that theory relies on a belief that environment causes genetic mutations, i.e. Europeans have light skins because they live in the cold north and they need to absorb much more sunlight, and that's why they've got light eyes and light hair and I don't know what all else, and that Africans are black because they live in the deep south of the southern hemisphere, where it's very dark and very hot all the time, so you don't need to absorb a lot of vitamin D, and that's why they've got dark skins and all this type of stuff. My problem with that theory is that the Asians, the Mongoloids, different, of course, I'm generalizing now because there are different subgroups amongst them as well, but they all live in the northern hemisphere as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if the north-south division theory holds true, which is a critical part of the out of Africa theory, if the north-south genetic mutation theory holds true, people living in the northern hemisphere should look the same, because they are subjected to the same environmental influences,
right?
Harsh winters, relatively warm, sometimes moderate summers, back into a harsh winter. They should all, but of course they don't. You'll find that people living on the same latitude or longitude, whichever it is, but the ones that run horizontally across the globe, I can't even recall which one it is now, God, advanced dementia. You'll find that people living in the same geographic spread look very different. And if the environment was the cause of genetic mutations, they should all look the same.
But we've also had some interesting, white people have had interesting migrations. I know some of this is probably obviously later, but we had, you know, European mummies in China. We have white Indians in America, white Chachapoyas of Peru, the Canary Islands, Easter. I mean, it's just really all over the place where you see, you know, white civilizations and then they've just mysteriously disappeared. But we seem to have been everywhere at one point. But you include a mural in your book of a white prisoner being sacrificed by Chichen Itza warriors, you know. Mm. So is it far-fetched to say maybe there have been, you know, white genocides in the past?
yes, I'm absolutely convinced of it. Depending on how you define white genocides, for example, the Tarim Basin mummies, which is the Indo-European group that got to Western China, the mm-hmm. Gobi Desert,
yep.
They were genocided out, not through physical extermination, but certainly through mixing with the locals. The people of the Tarim Basin to this day speak Turkic. They don't speak Chinese. And you can see the actual physical countenance is clearly a mix between Chinese and European. Now, it's still all very much up for debate, and it's made more difficult by the establishment's refusal to investigate the full extent of who were the original North and South Americans. The very basic evidence that we have now indicates that there was certainly a European presence of some sort. It's very difficult to say exactly whether it was a dominant presence or whether it was an interloper presence, but it was there's certainly more than enough evidence to indicate that this was. The Chichen Itza sacrifices that you're talking about, I think those were probably just Canary Island washovers who were caught in the cross current, the same one that took Columbus to that part of the world. Then they ended up in what is today modern Mexico, and they certainly probably got sacrificed for their trouble. I'm not sure one can go as far as saying that those were huge numbers of whites who were genocided, but as I said, all that speculation, we don't know. If one day perhaps there is a reordering of governments and society which will allow proper investigation of these things, which will allow proper analysis of ancient remains in North America and Central America, which, as I'm sure you know, is currently forbidden by law. The NAGPRA, the law which George Bush brought in, forbidding anyone except American Indians from claiming ancient remains on the presumption that they are Mongoloid origin. If that gets reversed and we're able to start doing, for example, what I'd really love to do, what would really be interesting, for example, would be to investigate the graves around the Nevada cliff dwellings.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That would be really interesting to have a look at the skeletal and find out what DNA we could extract from the tooth enamel of graves in that area. Because the Nevada cliff dwellings, for example, are so un-Indian that it simply isn't true. They're particularly European-looking cliff dwellings, and they're just not replicated anywhere else in the entire North American continent. So that would indicate that that was built by people different from the American Indians. But until the political climate changes, I don't think we're going to be able to make any final call on that.
That's unfortunate. I wanted to go back to an idea we were talking about, colonizers. Now, in your opinion, you know, we always hear that Europeans, they were also fleeing to find better conditions. So was it wrong for them to abandon Europe and go somewhere else? Should they have stayed there and fought hard for their continent?
Well, the age of exploration and the age of European colonization, Europe wasn't under a direct threat at that stage of the game. The great non-European invasions had all been more or less defeated by the time of the age of exploration and the age of colonization. And yes, you can see it. For example, it's no coincidence that Christopher Columbus was sent off to discover the Americas. He didn't know he was discovering the Americas, of course, but he was sent off across the Atlantic in the same year that the Moors were finally driven out of Spain, 1492. That's no coincidence. The Turks had been, the Ottoman, the Muslims had been defeated at the gates of Vienna in 1683, and they were being pushed back all the time. So it's no coincidence that the European colonization process started once the great non-European invasions of Europe had been defeated and turned back and were being driven back. So I don't think it's accurate to say that they were fleeing anything. It was just the natural European inquisitiveness. They knew where India was, and they were looking for a better place or a quicker way to get to India. And that was probably more of an economic motivation. If anybody did flee Europe, it was probably to escape feudalism. It was probably for economic reasons. You know, most of the early homesteaders who came to the U.S., unless you were born into privilege and wealth in Europe, you basically had no chance of acquiring land or property of your own. In this regard, I'm reminded of what Thomas Jefferson wrote about. He warned America about building cities. And he said, a very famous quote, and he said, "No, we can't build cities because we will soon become as heaped up with each upon each other and become as corrupt as the Europeans." He warned against cities. It would have been more ideal to keep America a more rural place, I think.
Oh, I agree. I definitely agree.
Yeah, and it suddenly struck me of, I think it was the Roman historian Terence, or was it Virgil? I think it was Terence. He wrote about Rome in the year 200 or 200 something, he wrote, Rome, that metropolis to which all evil things in the world are drawn. The nature of cities hasn't changed much.
Have you explored much of Scandinavia and some of the mounds up there? It's amazing how they don't do any digging around Scandinavia. It's just like it's not allowed. They don't want people to know about their Nordic heritage up there.
Very much so, very much. Unfortunately, that's not only limited to Scandinavia. Scandinavia is great. The last time I was in Malmö in Sweden, I was really disappointed because Malmö is becoming, as you know, a hellhole now. Yeah. But yes, you're right. Unfortunately, that anti-Nordicism is not limited to Scandinavia. I'm sure you're aware of the discoveries made by that Canadian archaeologist a year or two ago, who found another Viking settlement in Canada. And she was, I forget her name offhand, but she was just sacked from her job. The Canadian government withdrew all her subsidies. She had all her papers seized. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Quite incredible. So, you know, as that, this goes in line with everything I'm saying about the political climate. Unfortunately, you're allowed to be black conscious, you're allowed to be Hispanic conscious, you're allowed to be American Indian conscious, you're allowed to have a black caucus, you're allowed to have a Black History Month, you're allowed to have a Jewish History Month, you're allowed to have American Indian History Month, but God help you if you have a White History Month, then you're just a racist.
Well, we just have to do it and not care about what people say, basically.
Well, I think that's a stage where it's come from. I was greatly amused to see a recent Ramsey Paul video where we finally addressed the issue of being labeled, where he said, look, people actually just don't care about the label. The label's now so used, if you say anything, you just get accused of it. You know, if you say, well, Israel, why does the Jewish lobby in America object to Donald Trump suggesting that they build a wall on the border with Mexico, whereas Israel's got a huge wall around it. So it's good in Israel, but it's bad in America.
Sure, yeah.
And their only answer is, oh, anti-Semite. And, you know, it doesn't work anymore. I don't think anyone cares anymore.
No. By the way, Ramsey Paul, we're friends, and he said to tell you that he loved your book. So it's funny that you bring him up because he asked me to say hi.
Oh well, that's great. I've never actually spoken to him. I was actually trying to get hold of him. No, I was watching his latest, or what I presume is one of his latest videos, how to beat anti-Semitism. I think that's a latest, very good video to watch. Very, very good video.
Now, you made a good point I wanted to come back to, because a lot of people worry about, you know, the European population. But there's more Europeans alive today than ever in history, right? We've gone through massive, you know, population losses in the past. So your idea is that we don't have to be so worried about that. It's not as dire as we think, right?
Well, it is on the face of it. I wrote a book called Nova Europa, which you might or might not be familiar with, and I'm made this exact point. I said, it's ironic that although there's never been as many Europeans alive ever in history as there are today, in reality, we've never been so close to extermination as we are today. Because each time in history where there's been a collapse, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Sumeria, so on and so forth. Each time when there has been a collapse, there's always been a white heartland which has been able to provide a new wave of European gene pool, a new wave of explorers, settlers, this type of thing. We're reaching the stage now where most of our heartlands are now being actually taken over. And if Europe should fall, and I must tell you that I'm quite pessimistic about Western Europe, if Western Europe should fall, there's actually not that many places left over. So, no, you're right. We do have very large numbers. But unfortunately, we are probably in the most dire situation that we've probably ever been in before. And once again, it's largely Europeans' fault, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
If I look, let's use Germany as an example, right? Now I know there's lots of causes of this, and that's a separate topic. But let's look at Germany today. All right, they say they've had 1.2 million quote, refugees, unquote, come into Germany. It's a lot more than that because they don't even know how many have come in. It's an absurd situation. Apart from the fact that they're not refugees at all because they've all left Turkey, which is a safe country. Anyway, they've all poured into Germany now, and the Germans are trying to cope with them. They're raping, rampaging, criminal rampage through Germany and through the surrounding countries. They've bombed Paris. They've bombed Brussels. It's just mad what's going on. It's absolutely insane. And you would have thought anyone who had half a brain cell, not even half a brain, but half a brain cell, would say, whoa, this is a bad idea. This is a really bad idea. And they would vote for someone who would say, right, no, end this. Nope, not having any more of this. We're gonna throw this lot out. They can all go back and, you know, we're going to be humanitarian about it. We'll help them in their countries. We'll stop backing the rebels in so-called rebels in Syria, and we'll stop the war in Syria by backing Assad and the good guys in Syria. We'll crush ISIS that way. We won't arm them and supply them under the guise of being moderate rebels. And we'll make sure we'll help them rebuild Syria in the Syrian cities in Syria. We won't invite them all to come here and smash our place. So now you would have think that would be in the logical, consequential, anyone normal would say that. So what they do, they have elections in Germany, and wow, 30% of them, or 28, 25% of them vote for the Alternative für Deutschland, the alternative for Germany, mm-hmm. which, between you and me, and pardon the language, it's a real half-assed party. I mean, they
gathered that.
They're saying the right things, but they're not saying the things which need to be said. Basically, what needs to be said is, well, no, that's it. Stopping immigration and all non-white immigrants out. You can go back to
your
countries.
They don't want to look like Nazis, right? They're the alternative to the right.
Boo-hoo, but they don't even believe it. They actually expelled some branch somewhere outside Frankfurt, I think it was, which actually struck a local election deal with the NDP. They actually expelled them because they dared have an alliance with the NDP, which is saying the things which need to be done. Anyway, the point being that only 25% of the voters in those three areas, the three states which voted recently, dared vote for the NDP, which means that 65% or 75% of voters still voted for the parties who are bringing all the invasion in. Now, that's a really worrying figure. That's a really worrying. Well, it's only worrying if you're unlike me, because I've crossed the psychological Rubicon, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. That's really worrying if you think, wow, anyone in their right mind would say, no, we need to stop this. And you know what? You look at the Front National in France. The Front National has also watered down its policies a lot, but even they struggled to get more than 35% of the vote. Which means that 60% of Frenchmen, and that's why they keep on losing when they have the runoffs in the presidential elections. That's why the Le Pens keep on losing the runoffs. They come second, and then all the communists, the conservatives, the liberals, and the communists all gang together, and all of a sudden they one party and they vote for the other people, and it's the same thing over and over and over again. So while I agree with you that there are lots and lots of Europeans alive today, sadly there's still what appears to be a majority of them still don't know or understand what is going on. Now, we can take two approaches to this. One approach we can take is say, yes, well, we need to alert them and wake them up. You know, we just need to reach them, tell them the truth, and the truth will make them free, blah, 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 all that stuff. Well, yeah, okay, let's just say that I've tried that, and I've found that most people have formed their opinions, and facts have very little to do with how they reach their opinions. A lot of it's driven on emotion, a lot of it's driven on personality, a lot of it's driven on a number of other factors, basically any other factor except the facts. So while whatever we say can be true, unless you can motivate a large number of people, and there's only been a few periods in history where that's actually been done. I don't have to mention which ones they are. Most people are motivated not by facts. So that's a real problem. Having said that, I'm not pessimistic over the future of the European people or the white race per se. The reason for that is that I think although we have larger numbers than ever before, I think we're going to go into a population bottleneck simply because our large numbers have upbred the stupid class amongst Europeans, that there are now more degenerate, stupid, brain-dead Europeans than ever before. And I think nature is remorseless with it. Nature isn't immoral. Nature is amoral. Nature doesn't say this is right or wrong. Nature says these are rules, live by them or die. And I think those Europeans who are incapable of understanding the laws of nature will die.
Yep.
And I don't think we can do anything about that. But what I do think is that as long as we who understand it take the necessary steps to secure a geographic area which is homogeneous and which can then serve as an attraction point for Europeans who understand what it is all about, then even if we're substantially reduced, even if we're reduced by 80%, our core will remain solid and anything is possible once all the white liberals vanish, which they will vanish as well.
So is thinking in terms of ethnostates really a luxury or a big dream at this point?
No, I don't think so. I think it's going to come about naturally. I think white flight is an inadvertent acknowledgement of the reality of that principle. It's not that people say, oh, white flight's just racism. No, it's not racism. It's simply because whites simply can't live in third world standards. I think that the concept of ethnostates will come about, and I think it'll come about sooner than what many people think. I think the developments in Eastern Europe are going to come about within the next couple of decades.
Now, do you see people moving to a different area, or should they stay where they're at? If someone's Swedish, shouldn't they stay in Sweden and fight for that land?
That's a real difficult one. It's easier for me to say, having moved around a lot.
At the same time, you need people to watch your back, right? You need your tribe of people.
It's all good and well to sit and say, yes, I'm standing my ground, and you're in Los Angeles, and you're standing your ground, and next minute there is only you and five other Europeans left. You can stand your ground as long as you want to, then you can be murdered for your principles. Or you can do like what's happening in South Africa. People can say, yeah, we're never leaving the Transvaal, the Orange Free State. That's the traditional Boer republics. That's our home. Yeah, you can do that. Or you can move to Orania, where you actually are not going to be murdered instantly. You might have to defend it eventually. I'm sure you'll have to defend it eventually. Of that, there's no doubt. But you can stand and be murdered for your principles, or you can move somewhere else where you can generate the seed of a new revival.
And it's going to take hard work. And I think some people don't want to do that. They don't want to make the sacrifices and have to start over somewhere else. But that's what it's going to take. We're going to have to be pioneers once again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you think it can't be done, think of your ancestors who did it over and over again. America was created by those people. I mean, the people who arrived in early America, what did they arrive with? They arrived with a few tools, which they brought across, and that was it. They were dumped down on the East Coast, and man, that was it. They had to get on with it. They had to move out. They had to build their own houses. They had to build their own wagons. They had to eventually start building their own weapons. They had to do everything from scratch. No, we can do it. It's easy to do it. much more difficult to get the willpower to do it.
Now, this is always the question. How do we appeal to the white masses if the facts and the hard-hitting truth isn't working? I mean, what's it going to take to reach those people? I mean, it seems like they respond to things like entertainment and superficial pop culture, right?
You're asking the wrong person to answer what appeals to the masses. I have crossed what I mentioned earlier, a psychological Rubicon. When I was younger and I was first involved in this craziness, called The Movement. I believe all we have to do is tell people what's going on. Yeah, they'll say, oh, yes, of course, I understand who controls the media. I understand, oh, yes, racial demographics, of course. How couldn't I? Why didn't I see this? And I saw this in South Africa, you know. You would explain to people that having a black maid and a black gardener and a cook boy and a... What, let me tell you about the house in which I was raised in southern Rhodesia. We had a cook boy, black. We had an ironing boy who would do all the ironing. We had a garden boy, and we had a house boy. So we had four, and their wives, and all their pickaninnies. I mean, when I think about it now, and this is normal for white colonists in Africa, I must tell you, mm-hmm. they had virtually an entire tribe living with you.
Yeah.
It was incredible. And it's still happening today because they still don't understand. You know, everyone talks about the white farmers being murdered in South Africa, and it is a tragedy. Don't get me wrong. It's terrible. I hate reading about it. But, you know, how many times haven't I spoke at a Transvaal Agricultural Union meeting in 1991 in Pretoria, and I told them that the die was cast and ANC government was coming. And what they needed to do quickly was mechanize, get rid of all their black laborers, and they needed for security and for land claim purposes. They're gonna have trouble if they've got, as they do even to this day, hundreds of black laborers on their farms. It's just gonna cause trouble with crime. It's gonna cause problem with land claims, all that type of stuff. Anyway, of course, they ignored me. Some of them even booed me. They'd, oh no, you know. Philemon's been working on my farm for him and his family for the last 100 years. You know, they've been in the family. They'll never do anything to us, blah, blah, blah. When you're living on a farm and you're outnumbered by your black farm workers 200 to 1,
mm-hmm.
you're asking for trouble. You're absolutely asking for trouble. So people who fail to understand that demographics controls everything, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You can lay out all the facts to them, and if they refuse to accept it as a reality, there's nothing more you can do. And this is where I passed my psychological Rubicon. I used to believe that if I just explained all of this to everyone, they'd say, oh, yes, of course. Oh, how could we be this stupid? You're right, Arthur. Yeah, we'll quickly support you. We'll vote for whatever party you tell us to vote for, and everything will be all right. Of course, they don't. Absolutely don't. And eventually, after many, many years, after maybe 25, 30 years of activism, I thought, well, either I'm crazy and deluded, or they are, one of the two. And I like to think that I'm not, so therefore they are. And then it suddenly struck me. People who are going to die will die no matter what you tell them. I'm reminded of a speech by Hitler, if I'm allowed to mention Hitler.
Of course.
A speech that Hitler gave once, he said, do not imagine that a nation of 60 million cannot die. All it has to do is decide to die, and it will. He was talking about Germany, of course. And that's a very valid thing. If people decide not to ignore racial reality, if they decide to ignore lessons of history and demographics and race, then they will die. That's a conscious decision they're going to take. And so I've switched my approach completely. I no longer attempt to win over the masses for a great revolution. My approach now is to recruit as many as I can to the understanding of what it's going to take, consolidate them in geographic area, stroke areas, and generate a new resource, a new gene pool for something that can happen in the future.
That's right. Quality, not quantity, right? More of a eugenic approach here.
That is right. I mean, honestly, sometimes when you look around at whites around you, do you really even want to live with them?
No. No.
Ah, well, this is it, you know. A hundred years maybe 60, 70 years of social welfare dependency in Britain has created a huge white underclass, which, God forbid, I'd prefer to live in Thailand rather than live with the white British underclass. And that's the same everywhere. And that's not knocking everybody, everyone knows what I'm talking about. You get degenerate whites, and I just wouldn't want to live with them any more than anyone else. And no, I'm convinced that we can recruit enough people to restart again somewhere else. But the critical thing is the geographic area. I'm not even worried about the numbers. The critical thing is the geographic area. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking so much, but
no, it's great. That's why you're here.
Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about with numbers. All right, people say, oh, how many people do you need in an ethnic state to make it viable? Not actually that many. There is a NASA project called the Hyperion. I think it's called Hyperion. Where they plan into it's a theoretical thing. Of course, NASA's on its last legs, but it's a theoretical group of scientists and people planning for interplanetary travel, what it would take to travel interplanetary. And with current propulsion systems, they say, well, to get to the nearest solar system, if they should ever send a rocket out there with people in there to colonize a new planet, how many people would they have to send to make a genetically viable planet? To colonize, to set up. What they've done is they've calculated, they've used geneticists, they've calculated if they had to send a certain number of people to another planet without any additional genetic input from Earth, how many people would they have to send to create a genetically viable colony which would not be afflicted by the problems of inbreeding?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, have I made myself clear?
Mm-hmm,
clear
yes.
With that? And the answer which came up was quite amazing, and it is really I'm just going to actually put it up here because it's actually well worth reading. The answer is quite incredible. You would think that you would need millions at least. In actual fact, not. They worked it out. Dr. Cameron Smith. He is an anthropologist and prehistorian at Portland State University in Oregon. He compiled the report in question, and I am right. It is called Project Hyperion. People can look it up. His report, which he compiled and handed in to them, said that the number of people which you would need to create a genetically viable colony on another planet, you could create it with between 14,000 and 40,000 people.
Huh.
Okay.
Well, that's encouraging.
That is. He says, yeah, I'm quoting from his report, a safe and well-considered figure is 40,000 for an interstellar migration population composed of an effective population of 23,400 reproductive male and females, the rest being pre- or post-reproductive individuals. This number would maintain good health over five generations, despite A, increased inbreeding resulting from the relatively small human population, B, depressed genetic diversity due to the founder effect, C, demographic change through time, and D, expectation of at least one severe population catastrophe over the five-generation voyage. So there you go. That's an extreme example, but the truth is, if you think about it logically, and if you think of the original founding European population, you'll see that probably the original founding population of all Europeans, all of them, is probably not more than a few hundred thousand. So no, I'm not worried about the grand scheme of things. I think we are going to lose in the coming racial bottleneck because they simply don't understand or don't want to understand what's happening. I think we're going to lose huge numbers, and we're going to be compressed geographically. We're going to lose a lot of territory.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if we have the advantage now of having an understanding of race, history, demographics, if we are reduced down to a few million who have this understanding, we will survive, and I'm sure we will create a huge resurgence later on in a generation or two's time.
I suppose, too, you'd want to recruit people who are very technological and maybe work in weaponry, right?
Yeah, that goes by the by. The other angle about ethnostates is people say, oh, well, the Jewish lobby won't let you do it, or America will bomb you, or whatever. The counter argument to that is, of course, is Mexico a world power? That's my question to you. Just say yes or no.
Nope.
All right. Why isn't Mexico a world power?
Well, because it's a third world population.
Because it's full of Mexicans, right? Yeah. Now, when America fills up with Mexicans, will America be a world power?
No.
I can't imagine Mexicans keeping those B-17 bombers going and all the missiles and all that type.
Yeah, they don't have a space program in Mexico, so no.
Well, there you go. So you understand that the demographic change that we're talking about is so immense, people don't grasp the vastness of it. Of what is coming, providing it isn't reversed. I must add that I'm always, obviously, my first choice is that it's reversed, that there's a populist political victory somewhere and that it's reversed. That's the first choice, obviously. But I just like to plan for plan B, just in case. But if it goes as it appears to be going, the racial demographic change is going to be so vast that the geopolitical order which we know today is going to be turned on its head.
Yes. Yeah, and we could use that actually to our benefit in the future.
Absolutely. There isn't going to be a great big policeman America saying, oh, no, you can't have an ethnostate in Eastern Europe, or no, you can't have an ethnostate in Oregon, or no, you can't have an ethnostate wherever. Because there ain't going to be no big American policeman.
Yeah.
There's going to be a second stroke, third world shambles. And they'll be too busy fighting over the scraps or who owns the palace to worry about what a few million Europeans are doing on the other side of the planet or on the other side of the continent.
I think that's why it's good what you're saying. We need to be planning for the future and start building something that people can come to in the future, because it's inevitable. This is going to fall. We're watching it fall. So we shouldn't be so concerned with all the hows and the whos, but more of like, what are we going to do about it now, right?
That's the critical thing. The ethnostate idea, and it's ironic in the extreme. I mean, as you know, the ethnostate idea has been around for a long time. In fact, the first ethnostate theorist was, of course, Theodor Herzl. Zionism is just nothing but Jewish ethnostatism.
Yep.
And he drew that up in 1896. The next ethnostate project was, of course, National Socialist Germany, and that was destroyed. And after that, it's basically been put on the back burner, or Japan is probably a good example of a functioning ethnostate. They're coming under increasing pressure. China is, Pakistan is, India is. They've all got laws which encourage Indian, Pakistani, Chinese, Japanese immigration only. So therefore, they could be, in the broader sense of the word, they could be called ethnostates. But apart from that, apart from Israel, the only other near ethnostate project to date has been the Orania people in South Africa and the Pioneer Little Europe movement, which are emerged in the 1990s, I should think. I mean, all that I've been trying to do with my Nova Europa book and my little website and that is just to try to popularize the idea and give it some practical impetus. That's all. But we do need to be planning for that. Having said all of that, one must never abandon completely the possibility that Europeans will wake up. If Europeans wake up, they can reverse everything overnight, literally. It's you know, the Europeans are so powerful, they just have to think that they can survive, and they will. Just to invert what Hitler said earlier. And I'm not yet completely convinced that Austria isn't going to be the first country in Europe to rebel formally. I mean, Hungary already has. Hungary is a great country. If you ever want to go and visit that country, it's a great place to visit. Poland's great. The Czech Republic's great. The Slovakia is great. Those are all nations which have already, European Russia, Belarusia, those places, those are all nations which have already seen and understood what's going on. And they are already nations with firmly established infrastructures. And I'm not convinced that, that there won't come a revival from that point of view. In this regard, you can watch what happens with the May this 22nd Austrian presidential runoff, where the FPÖ stands a good chance of taking the presidency of Austria, and that might spark off an FPÖ government, which the rest of Europe's going to go mad. The rest of liberal Europe's going to go mad again. And who knows where that can lead. But just in case that doesn't happen, we should have a plan B.
And simultaneously have our people getting into politics. I say this all the time. Where's our people? Where's our parties? Where's our watch groups? We shouldn't abandon that either, right?
Absolutely. I do think that was a great mistake of the post of the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s so-called movement in America of retreating and waiting for the establishment to fall, and then the great Turner Diaries White Liberation Army would rise up and seize power. Of course, it's just it's fantasy. I think that people should have been out there campaigning as hard as they could. Even if you didn't win, you would have just racially conscientized so many more people. You know, Donald Trump's the case in point. He hasn't set out to racially conscientize anything. I think if anything, he's run incredibly multiracial campaign. But just saying one or two half sensible things has conscientized millions of people. And that, yeah, that shows what can be done under the right circumstances.
Meanwhile, in London, your first Muslim mayor, right? How's that going?
Well, that's only a shock for those who haven't been following the immigration invasion into Europe. People don't know Birmingham's had a Muslim mayor before. Birmingham's the second largest city. There's a black mayor of Bristol, the town of Bristol. That's old hat. I mean, whites are an absolute minority in London. Whites are an absolute minority in Birmingham. They're close to a minority in Manchester. And those are your three biggest cities in Britain.
And people are celebrating becoming a minority over there, right? Meanwhile, all the non-whites know that demographics matter most. They know that that's what it takes to win.
Well, there's an intrinsic understanding to that. Just getting back to what I was saying earlier about people worried about what the Jewish lobby will say about an European ethnostate. The Jewish lobby is only powerful as long as Europeans are in charge. For some peculiar reason, and there has to be a reason for it, and I haven't yet had the time or the interest to fathom it, but when countries swing majority non-white, the Jewish lobby loses its power. And it's a very self-defeating thing for the Jewish lobby to encourage non-white immigration because they will end up losing. Can you imagine, for example, a Vicente Fox-controlled U.S. government in Washington, D.C. continuing to pump $4 billion a year into Israel?
No.
When they've got hundreds of millions of Hispanics on their food stamps. No, that's not going to happen. Israel's funding is going to dry up. The day that America collapses is the day Israel's funding dries up.
That's right. It's generally only white people that care about Israel.
Correct. In fact, I would go even further. I'd go and say that the non-white world is probably inherently hostile to Israel because of the way Israel's treated the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So it's a very self-defeating thing. And that also... I think once that happens, once the swing of that nature happens, it's also going to take the teeth out of the Jewish lobby's ability to affect anything else anywhere as well.
I know we're getting ready to close here, but I wanted to ask you about one more thing. You write about the third great race war, which is, you know, the Moors invading Europe. How is it that Europeans have forgotten that we fought off Arabs before?
That's a good question. I think ultimately the outcome of the Second World War has to be the biggest deciding factor in that. I think prior to the Second World War and all the propaganda that has followed it, I think most Europeans had an understanding of race and racial world issues. I think America led the world before World War II in terms of eugenic research. Certainly far more developed than what anything the Germans had. And I think the advent of the Second World War and the propaganda fallout from that war has caused the science of race to be completely suppressed. And anyone who even raises the topic is subject has been subjected to endless smears and attacks. And at the same time, the communists, the Reds, have had the long march through the institutions. With the result, people don't know anything about race anymore. I think that's the real reason. They actually believe that importing the Middle East into Europe is going to make them Europeans in a few years instead of importing the chaos of the Middle East into Europe. That's what they actually appear to believe. And I can only ascribe to the outcome and the propaganda following the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, it just blows my mind. I mean, European women, in Europe have been raped by non-white invading hordes for a long time now, and now we're inviting back in some of these same bloodlines. It's pretty outrageous. And they're doing the same thing, right?
That's it. Someone said to me just today, made this exact point, which you're making now, is that the only people who appear to have changed appear to be the Europeans. Everyone else is acting true to form, which is really a sad thing to think about. But as I said to you, if that's what they're going to believe, and when all the facts are staring them in the face, well, then that's what they're going to believe. What we have to do, we have to step up our recruiting efforts and recruit as many people, awaken as many people as possible to those who are receptive to the idea and make them understand that great sacrifices are coming, but if they make the sacrifices, our future is assured.
What always drives me nuts, too, when I hear European people saying, well, we need to race mix, you know, it's survival's about adapting to change, so we need to blend in. Have you heard that?
I've heard that and much worse. I've heard people say, yeah, well, nothing you can do about it. The one thing, and this might tread on a listener's toes, and if it does, it's a case of veritas odium parit, truth purchases hatred. The one thing that I have noticed is that so-called white nationalist activists tend to be those with the fewest children.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
I think that's a serious issue, which unless all these activists who run around saying 14 words and preserve a future for our children, unless they themselves start living this out, everything becomes pointless without children.
That's true. That is absolutely right. Well, Arthur, I've really appreciated your time today. I'm honored to have you here. And please tell everyone how they can buy your books. They really need to help support you. I actually bought your complete volume of March of the Titans last night so I could have it digitally. Loving it. It's great to go back to. I think people should share it with their friends and family and children. But tell people how they can get your work.
Okay. Well, you can get March of the Titans on Amazon, of course. Great miracle of modern marketing that website is, or you can get a good spread of everything else that I do on astarapublications.com. That is Astara as in goddess of the spring, Astara, Ostara publications.com, Astara publications, one word, and you'll basically get everything that you need to know there.
So does that mean you enjoy a lot of the Nordic pre-Christian traditions?
Yeah, well, Astara I chose because it symbolizes rebirth. You know, Easter, the celebration of Easter, yes, as we have it today, is taken from Astara. And the goddess Astara was the goddess of spring, of new life. That's why she had the egg and the rabbit as her symbols, because the egg is the symbol of fertility. And there's few animals more fertile and more reproductive than the rabbit. And that's where the Easter bunny comes from. And that's where the Easter egg comes from. So I thought, well, if I'm going to pick something which symbolizes what I feel, then it's going to be about revival, rebirth, new life.
Very nice. Well, thank you so much for your time this evening. I really appreciate it.
Lana, thanks so much for having me.